The idea of having a quiet mind. When I first started practicing meditating, which I encourage people to do, not from any Far Eastern guru loincloth kind of thing at all, but as a way of understanding that there's another dimension. If I were to take you, the listener, and to put you in chains, and to put you in a dungeon, and to deny you light and human contact for the rest of your life, you would probably say to yourself, this is the end. I mean, this is the end. I can't handle this. There are some people, believe it or not, among us, who, if you were to do that very same thing, would say, this is a beginning. There's a whole world there. If any of us were forced to learn how to go into that world, we would discover many, many, many things about ourselves. And I'm talking about the world of the mind. It's not an accident that all of the great spiritual masters have encouraged a kind of meditation of one kind or another, and that most advanced people, most awakened people, practice it on a regular basis. It's not an accident. You begin to discover how slimy your mind is. The thoughts that you have all the time, and how much disasterizing we do with our minds, and how much stuff that we occupy our minds with that is so unnecessary and so silly, so foolish, so destructive, that quieting our mind and meditating really go hand in hand. Now, meditating doesn't require a lot of training. It doesn't require somebody teaching you exactly how to do it or whatever, because that defeats the purpose of meditating. When you meditate, you really want to go in there and quiet your mind. And what you want to be able to do in your life is to have an open but not a rampage going on inside of your mind, not a thousand thoughts barraging it. And these thoughts that you have, these are yours. These are your creation. I used to tell people as a therapist, if you don't believe that you're in control of your thoughts, then I want you to tell me who is. Then I want you to find all those people who are in control of your thoughts and send them all to me. Then I will treat them and you will get better, which is absurd. Obviously, you're not going to get better by treating somebody else. You are the creator of thought, which means that in some metaphysical way, you're the creator of your life. Thought originates with each one of us. But most of us have trained ourselves to believe that whatever we think just sort of happens, and thoughts just sort of, I call it the pop-in theory, you know? They just sort of pop in, and I can't help it. Boop, there's a thought, and it's just there. And I can't help it, it just happened. That isn't true when you train your mind. We spend so much of our energy training ourselves in all kinds of areas. We train ourselves in business. If we're going to get a new computer system, we go out and we spend millions of dollars in a company and we train people how to work it. And we want to become good at golf or swimming or tennis or backgammon or anything that you can think of. We know that we got to go out and we got to practice and we got to train ourselves. We train ourselves and we ignore our mind, which is 99% of who we are. We just completely ignore it. Like there's no training available for our minds. And we can all do that. I've really learned how to do it myself. No one ever taught me. You know, when I used to teach at a university, I taught in Berlin for half a year. There were 70 students in the class. And I would have the first student introduce themselves and their name. Then I would have the second student introduce the person who was just introduced and himself. And each time I would repeat it. And I'd have the third student introduce the two that he had just introduced plus himself. And we'd do that for the whole class. By the time we got to the 70th student, they had to introduce everybody in the class by name, and I would then repeat each one of them. And I just had a very simple technique for doing that. It was just like concentrated effort on making my mind remember 70 people's names in an hour and a half. Now, I wasn't doing it to waste an hour and a half. This was a class on teaching people how to identify neurotic behavior in people. And it's like what I wanted to do was to teach them that they could do things with their minds, just like their patients do, that they never thought of, that they never even dreamt were possible for them. 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, they would have like 80-90% recall. And by the end of the fourth or fifth week, everybody knew everybody's name in the class, and they had all trained themselves. And most people go out there and they're introduced to somebody, and they say, hello, my name is Wayne. They say, what would you say your name was? They can't remember one person's name in 1 minute. And they think that, oh, I have a poor memory. But it's because they don't train. Well, the mind can be trained, and meditating is a perfect way to do that. And there's a wonderful world in there, in your mind. Quieting your mind means that you're no longer susceptible to all of the external influences that are around you. I'm always amazed when I watch the U.S. Open tennis championships that are played in New York right near LaGuardia at how the players are able to continue playing with jets going on overhead. And yet, when I am really completely involved in a tennis match, I've had people where I've played, I've had jackhammers going next to me, and my opponent is going crazy. They have to go over there, and I tell them, I don't notice it. My concentration is on the ball, and I don't hear that lawnmower going off or the jackhammer going or the airplane going on overhead. We can train ourselves to do that. The people who are really good at any game or any activity that requires concentration know how to do that. Well, we all want to be able to be better at that, and we don't want to have our minds occupied particularly with worry and anxiety and stressful kinds of things. So you have to learn how to focus your mind, how to get focused, and keep yourself from creating those kinds of thoughts that are always impinging on your consciousness. Miracles are available there. You talk about surrendering. I meditated for a long time. It's like there would be a light. I would have this light that I would create. And it's really interesting that you can create a light with your eyes closed in a dark room. So you don't really need your eyes to create light. You need your mind to create light. Your mind can create light. And all of us do it in our dreams. We can create a color in our dream without any light. So that our minds are capable of producing that, and our minds can create smells, and we can create sounds. We do all of that in our dream, and that's just a pure thought state. So what you want to do is get to that pure thought state. I use a technique that I just invented myself. It just worked for me. I close my eyes. I only have to do this for 10 or 15 minutes, and it's the equivalent of getting 8 hours of sleep, literally. And it's the most exhilarating, energy-producing, feeling like I can conquer anything, knowing that I can't be defeated attitude. That just comes from peacefully quieting my mind. If I'm giving a speech and I give a break, oftentimes I will just go back into a room and re-energize myself. And it's literally like getting a full night's sleep, only I'm more energized, because oftentimes you're groggy after sleeping for so long. And it's really just closing my eyes and creating like a pastel field. And my mind can create any color that I want, which is just so astounding. You think you need your eyes to create it, and you don't at all. And I create that field. In my mind, I put a barrier around that field, and I won't let anything into it. And any thought that tries to penetrate that barrier sort of bounces back. And it takes about 2 or 3 minutes to get yourself like totally relaxed. Now, I don't really believe that anybody can just not think at all. I think that's part of the trap. It's part of the human condition. That thinking always goes on. Even thinking about not thinking is still thinking. But you don't have extraneous thoughts. You get like single-minded. And this is wonderful, wonderful training for anyone. And so it's like as you do that and you just won't let a thought in and you won't let a thought in and you won't let a thought in, you become very, very, very relaxed. And then you can create whatever you want. I create a light. It's like a white light, a spotlight way off in the distance in my mind. And I approach it. I just keep coming closer and closer and closer to it with this pastel feel keeping any thoughts from bombarding it. It's amazing how at the beginning, when you first start this, how it's hard to go 5 seconds. 5 seconds without having some kind of thought impinge on. Boom, all of a sudden you catch yourself doing that. Then you get to 10 seconds, you get to 30 seconds. And before long, you can do a couple of minutes. And as I move and move towards the light, for many years, I was afraid of the light. I would get close to it, and I knew that if I went into it, that something was going to happen that I didn't know. And so I'd always sort of approach it, and then I'd come back. And then I allowed myself just to go through it. I just surrendered to it. I said, I can handle it. I created miracles in that space for myself and in the world that I came back to when I left the meditation as well. I do that on a regular basis. The result, the peacefulness, the harmony, the serenity, the energy that you begin to get when you just take a few minutes a day, 10 or 15 minutes a day, put yourself into a sensory deprivation kind of atmosphere, a tub of water under a tree in a meadow, and just go into your mind and begin to see the world. And you begin to see, as I said, how slimy your mind is, how much stuff you are constantly using that you don't need to, how many bad and negative and worrying and hurtful thoughts that keep impinging on it, keep trying to break that field. You let them bounce off. You let them bounce off. You let them bounce off. And before long, it's like you're only letting harmony in. This is what I believe any one of us can do. Any one of us can only let harmony in. We don't have to let anybody into our consciousness because all they are is just thoughts anyway, unless they come there with harmony. Now, that's like a commitment that you could make, that if you come with disharmony, discordance, anger, stress, tension, you only get to my form. You only get to the package. But unless you come with love, harmony, serenity, peace, whatever, you don't get to who I really am. You don't get there because I'm beyond the need to have conflict and confrontation occupying my soul. I just don't need that any longer. I'm gone through the gate. I'm past that. I'm gone through the light. I look at that as no longer my need to prove that I can deal with it and handle it. That's gone. So I was on an airplane, and we were flying from Miami to San Francisco, and the plane taxied out, and it got to the runway, and there was a light that came on in the cockpit, and the pilot announced that we wouldn't be able to take off. We're going to have to go back to the gate because the stabilizer that takes care of the wing flaps or something wasn't registering as working properly, and we'd have to go back. There's going to be a two-hour delay. And my immediate attitude when something like that happens is, you're not supposed to get to San Francisco in 5 hours, okay? That when my ancestors wanted to get to San Francisco from Miami, if they left in September, and if they got there in March, April, they considered that on time. And it was a good trip if half the people were still alive, all right? It was very successful. If they could get there, if it took them 9 months or a year to get there in wagons and so on, then if it's going to take me 2 more hours or whatever, and if the stabilizer isn't working on that aircraft in anything that stabilizes anything, I want to go back to the gate. Okay? I'm not interested in being angry about that or anything. That's a part of surrendering. It's just understanding. I was in first class. The stewardess was standing there, and she said, oh, no. Oh, no. She knew who I was. I had been talking to her. And she said, this is what I dread. I said, what's the matter? She said, there's 176 people on this plane. Every one of them is going to say something nasty to me when they get off the plane. They're going to blame me. They're going to blame the airline. And they're going to... I said, but you don't have to let that in. She said, what are you talking about? I said, well, you've got two packages, two suits that are protecting you from anybody coming to you with that disharmony. She said, what do you mean? I said, well, you got your uniform. I said, that's one package. And that's over the other package, which is your body. And then both of those are protecting or covering who you really are, which is how you choose to process all of this and how you choose to think and who you really are. I said, each person that comes up by you and says something negative or nasty, you can just let that only be a message to your uniform, to your package. That's not me. And you can remind yourself, they're not talking to me. They can't get to me with that stuff. They can't have that. I don't let anybody come to me unless they come with love or harmony to who I really am. So you can just say, well, I'm very sorry, and have a good one. And it's like, and you say, well, they didn't get to me, and they didn't get to me. They're not reaching me with that. And sure enough, she stood there and she watched as 176 people got off, and I'd say 150 of them said something nasty to her on the way out. And each time she just sort of smiled and said, yes, well, it'll be 2 hours. And she gave them instructions on where to go. And when it was all done, she sat down next to me. She said, that was fantastic. It's the first time that we've ever had a circumstance like this where I didn't let it bother me. I said, you don't have to let that stuff into your life. And it's just like in the meditation, in the field. When those thoughts start impinging on the field, the pastel that you have created, you don't have to let them in. They bounce. And the more you do that, the more you allow yourself the right to have only what you want to enter your consciousness. You just make that choice all the time. I do it all the time. When I'm driving, and if anybody gives me, I don't take any of that inside. I just say, oh, that's them, and that's how they're reacting to my form. But if somebody comes to me with love, with serenity, with peace, with joy, with ease, whatever, then you can have all of me. I will respond back with that. So you let in whatever you want. That's what meditating does for you. That's what a quiet mind does for you. It allows you to select what you allow into who you really are, without having to be a slave to every single person who's out there and every single action that's out there that doesn't fit in with the way you want it to be. Having a quiet mind in a practical sense is really understanding that what I'm talking about is not just for discussion, it's for application. If you're the kind of person who has your mind filled with 10 different things that you have to do, and that is producing anxiety, stress, ulcers, colds, backaches, headaches, cramps, runny noses, all of the kinds of physical reactions and manifestations of that kind of thinking, then you have to look at how can you just get a blank mind, or how can you get a quiet mind? How can you just understand that, supposing you're thinking about, you got to get to work, you've got this report you got to get out, you got to get your taxes done, you got to stop and get some diapers on the way home. Now the kids need to have bananas, and they've got dance lessons I've got to get them to. An endless catalog of activities. By using your mind to do that and to occupy it all the time, none of that is going to get done. See, all of that is going to get done. Regardless, if you're the kind of person who does those things, it's going to get done. The question is, how do you use your present moments? See, any time you use up your present moment, or any time that you are thinking anxious thoughts, you're denying the present. You're using up the present moment instead of using it up in a productive, peaceful, serene, calm way, you are somehow believing that you can't get through this day or this moment any other way, that if I don't think about it and worry about it and be anxious about it. But the fact is, it's going to get done. Your taxes are going to get done. You're not going to jail. You're not the kind of person who's going to opt to just simply not do your taxes. You're going to get the diapers. You're going to get the report done. All of that, you're going to get done. Otherwise, you wouldn't be in the position that you're in. You would be doing something else, all right? So if you know that it's going to get done, the question is, what's the most efficient and effective and peaceful way to get things done? I use the analogy often of when you're in a hurry, like when your body is in a hurry. That's when you're least effective. And that's when you always drop something. You'll drop the keys, and then you'll start sweating. And then when you start sweating, you find yourself getting more upset. You'll forget something. And you'll walk out the door, and you'll slam the door, and you left the key on the inside. Now you don't have a key. I've talked about when you take a shower. If you rush through a shower because you only have 5 minutes to take a shower, and you finish, and you take your shower, and then you dry yourself off, you didn't need to take a shower because you're already dirty again. I mean, you're already sweating. You can take the same 5 minutes and take a shower if that's all you have. And you can do it peacefully. The same 5 minutes. You can push all of the other stuff out, and you can just relax. And if you've got 3 minutes, instead of rushing through it, you can just let the water pour. You can experience the water. You can wash your body. You can dry it all off. And when you finish, you're not sweating. And you had the same amount of time. The nervousness and all of that comes from the way that you decide to press. Now, in the physical world, you understand that if you hurry and rush and are filled with 1,000 different activities, that you have decreased your efficiency. Why isn't the same thing true in the mental world, in your mind? If you are filling your mind with all of the things that you have to do, and you're worried about all of those things and get yourself all consumed with them, then you're still going to be less efficient, less effective, and you're still going to be cluttered. At a moment like that, you put on a tape. If you're going to drive, you got to drive. You can't get the bananas and the diapers and the report done and the IRS taken care of in the car on the freeway. You can't do that then. You're driving. So why not be here now, as Ram Dass says? Be here now. Here's some music. Put on a tape. Meditate right there. Don't close your eyes. But just, like, push it all out. All of that's going to get handled. But meantime, I'm going to enjoy this. My ride from my home to my office is 17 miles. I love those 17 miles. There's a million things to see in those 17 miles. I cannot write my books or get my speeches. I can't do any of that in that time. But I can enjoy all of that. I can be there with it. I can open the windows, and I can let the wind blow on me, and I can experience that and enjoy all of that. And when I get to where I'm going, if I've got to get the report done, I'm now prepared to do it. I'm not working on the report thinking about my taxes or getting the diapers or getting the bananas or whatever it may be. I'm here now, in the moment. That's what meditating teaches you, being here now, in the moment, quiet, joyful. Peaceful. When you're there and you get your mind trained to do that, that isn't just like something you do for 15 minutes a day just to give you something to do for that 15 minutes. That carries over into everything that you do. You suddenly find yourself slowing down, and the more peaceful you are, the more efficient you are. The more you're in a hurry, the more you're always trying to get someplace fast, the chances of having an accident are greater. The chances of you getting there all ruffled are much greater. The chances of your heart rate going up are much greater. Your pulse is going to go faster. Your stomach is going to be upset. None of that is worth it. None of that is useful. Meditating teaches you that you have the capacity to use your mind any way that you want to. And you suddenly begin to see that everybody else out there who is in a frenzy and all upset and worked up, that you don't have to go there. It doesn't have to be that way. I just spent a week on Bali. As we went out across the island, I noticed some really interesting things that were really helpful to me. There was a very, very busy intersection in a town called Denpasar. There was an accident, and a little boy was killed. He was 13 years old while we were there. It happened the first day we were there. There are a lot of accidents there. The roads are real, real bad, and there seems to be a lot of crazy driving. And it's so inconsistent with so many of the people that we met. So many paradoxes there. At any rate, at this very, very busy, busy location where this little boy was killed, the immediate family of the boy went to the accident site, and they placed flowers and burnt incense all around this place, and they sat there in the middle of the intersection for 3 days, 72 hours, 3 solid days, praying for the soul of this little boy. And not once did you hear a horn. And not once did you hear anybody screaming and yelling, get out of the way. This was a very, very spiritual place. Just unbelievably like that. We went into homes where people had 10 and 11 children, and they had 3 huts where they would sleep. And I took my children in there with me. They would sleep on these, like, matted floors. And with 11 children in these little huts, there was almost no noise. And there's a quietness about the people. They're really attached to nature. They're very close to God in whatever that means. Every home on the island has a temple. No matter how small it is, they have a little temple in the back. When you go into the temple, you have to wrap something around your waist to remind you to leave the physical world behind and just enter there, only spirit, only thought. My wife and I had almost a spiritual experience of being there, of realizing that we don't need any more. We think we need more. We're always trying to get more. Not just us, but I mean, I'm talking about all of us here in the Western world. We sort of believe that our happiness and fulfillment is dependent upon accumulating more and getting more. And we saw all these people who had so little, and yet they were so close to nature. They were so close to God. It was almost like God was right there with them. Healthy, beautiful-looking people. It was astonishing when I flew out of there. Because when I first arrived there, I had just been on a 5-city tour of Australia, speaking to large crowds and all that. And it took me 2 days of wanting to leave Bali. I'd always wanted to get there. And there I was, and I wanted to leave because I wanted more of the helter-skelter, the rush that I had been accustomed to in Australia, taking me every place, limousines, and having people take care of everything for you, and thousands of people listening and selling books and the whole thing. All of a sudden, all of that was gone. And it was like I couldn't adjust. And finally, by the third day, I realized that I got to stay here. Just stay with it. Just go with it. And that's when I got out into the island and stayed there. Well, only stayed there a week. Flew out of there, went to Hong Kong for a couple of days, and then flew back to San Francisco. And when I got into San Francisco, I was just struck by what's going on in this country. And I've lived here all my life. And all the time in Bali, not one person did I ever see who was anything other than a perfect, beautiful specimen physically. Not once. Did I see any? And I saw thousands and thousands of people. I made a point to go into their homes and get way out into the boondocks. When I got on the airplane, people were walking by, and most of the people were overweight on the plane. Not fat, enormous, corpulent. Their faces looked flushed, and they didn't make eye contact with you like they did there. They were huffing and puffing in the land of plenty. And you know what it is? It's when you have so much, you have a tendency to look in each other's wallet instead of each other's eyes. That's what happened. It's like it chokes me up just to think about it. We're always looking in each other's wallets. We're always saying, how much do you have, and how much do you have, and how much of yours can I get, and I'm going to get yours before you get mine. And we're a whole culture of people like that. And when you have so many, you can't look in people's eyes. You can't look there and see, you know, the joy and the love and the humanity. And that's all there is. That's all we have. We've gotten past all of that. We would call that country uncivilized. We would call that country barren. And these are like naked savages, perhaps. And yet we could use a lot of that. We really could. We've got to stop looking in each other's pocketbooks and get back to looking in each other's eyes.
This has been a Nightingale Conant production for Simon & Schuster Audio.